Hi, everyone. I know I'm not the voice you're used to hearing on Tectonic, so let me quickly introduce myself. I'm Vanessa Lucero, TSA's podcast producer, who's usually, and quite happily, behind the scenes. Today, we're celebrating a major milestone, our 100th episode. Over the years, Thomas has welcomed incredible guests and led conversations filled with thought-provoking, insightful ideas, all with the goal of helping the tech community grow and thrive. To mark the occasion, we've handpicked some of the most memorable moments from the past 99 episodes. Whether you've been with us since the beginning or just tuned in recently, thank you for being a part of this journey. Now, let's jump into the highlights that got us here.
One of our earliest episodes was with renowned business guru, Jeffrey Moore. In this clip, he outlines his fantastic framework for how to organize a company to incubate a new business model.
Yeah, and let me start by saying, because I want to kind of frame the problem the way you framed it. We have a little, if you're a consultant, you either have 2x2 matrices or triangles. That's about it. That's all the graphics they teach you. And this one is a triangle. A triangle has a top, a middle, and a bottom.
Right.
And the top is business model. And the idea is when you change business models, that's going to cascade down to a completely new operating model, which is going to cascade down to a completely different infrastructure model. And the reason why I mention that is a lot of when we talk about digital transformation, people tend to gravitate toward the infrastructure model.
Right.
But they got to realize, yeah, but that's in service to a new operating model, which is in service to a new business model. And I actually think it's the operating model that's the thing where all the inertial momentum that resists change is coming from. Because Zone to Win is really an organizational design around an operating model. And basically all it says is, look, if you are in one of these legacy companies, you have a core business. This is feeding the beast.
It's paying the bills.
It's paying the bills. It's everything. And it wants investment. I mean, it's not like it's a cash cow. It wants investment. And it's not just money. It wants talent and attention and ecosystem relationships and all kinds of things. And as long as innovation is essentially aligned with the core business, you're fine. So Google and Facebook and Amazon have been growing pretty without a lot of hiccups to date because, by and large, their new businesses either were so far afield that they didn't really interfere with the core business, or they were aligned with the core business and kind of amplified it.
Mm-hmm.
But sooner or later, you come to a situation where the new business model is antithetical is probably too strong a word, but it's disruptive to and potentially cannibalistic of their core business. And now what you have is you have this conflicted problem, and you're inherently conflicted. And if you're a startup, you're not, because the startup only has the new business model. But if you're a legacy, you've got both. So how do you deal with that in a principled way? So what we said was four zones, two zones for the core business, the performance zone and the productivity zone. Performance zone, that's the one that makes the number every quarter. It's the one that the earnings analyst you talk about, you know, in your quarterly earnings call. Everybody gets that one. Productivity zone, all the cost centers behind the scenes that support the performance zone. Finance, HR, IT, cybersecurity, facilities, marketing, customers, and anything you don't charge the customer for. And that's the core business, and it's 90% plus of the budget, and it's where all the operational focus of the company is. Okay, now we see the next wave. We're not stupid. We know it's coming, either because a competitor has brought it to our door, or we think maybe it's one we could grab onto ourselves. But either way, we say, okay, we want to develop that. It's clear that the governance model for the performance zone does not apply. This thing is not at scale. We're not trying to harvest it. We're not trying to make money from it. We're just trying to figure. So we're not going to use the performance zone model. It's also interesting. The processes from the productivity zone also are not fit for purpose because they're designed to support scaled operations with, you know, steady as you go, measure twice, cut once. We're over here trying to figure out product market fit. We don't know what the hell's going on, right? So everybody kind of gets that you can't use those models. And by the way, most companies do sequester their incubation efforts off to the side. The first mistake they make is because they know that the performance zone model governance model is wrong, because they know the productivity zone governance model is wrong, they say no governance model. That's wrong too.
Mm-hmm.
You need a governance model, and the right model is the venture capital governance model, not the financial model, but the governance model. So the incubation zone is a zone where you set up a venture capital operating model, not financial operating model, but you fund startups, you worry about getting to minimum viable product, you worry about crossing chasms, you worry about all the things that venture capitalists worry about. And you measure everything by power metrics, not performance metrics. So sales matter, but not because $10 million of sales managers to manage means anything to Dell.
Yeah, it's a rounding error. Right.
Exactly. But the fact that you got $10 million from competitive situations and customers paid you that money is a signal, hey, you might be onto something.
Mm-hmm.
And so you want those market signals. So you're, just like a venture capitalist, you keep on looking for those signals. You fund it like venture capital. You fund to the next milestone. You do not fund during the annual planning process. No venture capitalist ever funded anything annually. But of course, corporations want to do it because that's their process. The productivity zone, that's their process, right? It's like, God bless you, but not for the incubation. So fund the zone annually, but then have a group inside the zone that does your funding. So those three zones, we work a bunch to get set up. And it's interesting, each company, I've worked out maybe with 10 or 15 companies doing this. It's interesting, often the zone they think is the problem is not actually the first problem to address.
Hmm.
They often have a problem someplace else that they have to address first.
Interesting.
And so, but anyway, using those three governance models, we do it. And then we get to this notion of transformation, meaning I have something in the incubation zone. It's ready for prime. It is time to take it to prime time. To say it's ready is a little bit of a misnomer because it's still young. It's not anything like what you're used to. But the world is sort of saying, hey, it's now or never. So come on. And so there's a couple of ways you can do that. If you can bolt it on to your core business, that's by far the lowest risk thing. It doesn't change your footprint that much, but you're in the game. Your customers say, hey, you're making progress. This is good. We'll stick with you. But a lot of times it's like, no, I really do have to rip the Band-Aid off and create a whole new structure. That's what the transformation zone is about. And this is kind of the come to Jesus time for the CEO, because you're about to undertake something that everybody's going to second guess you for the rest of your life.
Right.
So, but the point is, if you don't, nobody else can. Because what you have to do in a transformation is tell every organization in the enterprise, I am adjusting your priorities. Transformation is the number one priority. And everything that you had as your number one priority is number two. And your number two is now number three. And your number three is now number four. And by the way, when we budget, we're going to fund this zone first. And we're going to fund it until if there's not a dollar that we can't use there. And then we'll figure out what to do with the rest. And it will play hell with your performance comp. It will play hell with all the things you're used to.
Yeah, this is very unpopular. This is very,
very
unpopular.
Very, very unpopular. But and so who does it? People that are good at being unpopular. Elon Musk, he's terrific at being unpopular. Steven Jobs, fabulous. Larry Ellison, gifted at being unpopular. And anybody who wants to be popular should run for student body president and not be the CEO. So those are the four zones.
What goes up must come down. Here is guidance we provided several years ago on how to navigate an economic downturn. It may come in handy this year. And advice for the individual tech professional. So let's start with the tech leader. And this content and insight comes from a paper that I published, How Successful B2B Companies Navigate an Economic Downturn. It's available for everyone on our website. And I can tell you, in the summer of 2020, when everybody was dealing with the pandemic, I met with 86 executive teams from TSI member companies to discuss how they were navigating the global pandemic. And in essence, everyone had a similar playbook that consisted of four main plays. Okay, number one, we're going to reduce operating costs because there's a lot of uncertainty. Number two, we're going to become more operationally efficient. Number three, we're going to work to retain our key talent. And then number four, we're going to try to identify new growth opportunities that will emerge, you know, as soon as this pandemic gets under control and the economy returns. And I can tell you, it is that fourth play that a majority of companies did not run successfully. So how do you manage against that mistake as a tech leader? Let me ask, have you ever downsized your way to growth? I don't think so. So the first tactic here is smart divesting. Cost cutting across the board during a downturn is a fatal strategy, especially when technology business models are in transformation. For tech companies that are working to migrate from transactional business models to recurring business models that are, you know, based on as a service type offers, there needs to be prioritization related to cost cutting. I mean, this can seem, you know, harsh, but legacy business units need to take the brunt of any cost-cutting initiatives. Do not
downsize business units that are responsible for the future growth of the company. Now, for the born in the cloud companies listening here, they only have one business model in play. Keep listening. Cheap money funds unprofitable business models. Money just got expensive. The second tactic here is really informed operational efficiency. In a downturn, profitability and cash flow become the currency investors want. But where are your greatest opportunities to improve profitability and cash flow? The answer to that question is not a mystery. Whether you are trying to optimize traditional maintenance revenue streams or improve the margin profile of a new managed service offering or improve your margins on your SaaS offering or start monetizing customer success, TSIA, we are well-versed in the practices that move the profitability needle. Answering that question is why we were founded almost 20 years ago, so don't guess. So you should reach out to industry experts like TSIA to get targeted advice on where to become operationally efficient. High company valuation is an employee retention strategy until it is not. This next tactic is about retention through mission. The tight talent pool facing technology companies is not completely loosening just because the economy is slowing down. We see this in the jobs report data. However, the carrot of recruiting and retaining talent with stock options just went out the window for most companies. So what now? It is the observation of TSI researchers and others that employees, especially the next generation of tech employees, gravitate to mission. They are looking for companies that can articulate a meaningful mission. Now, you may be thinking, hey, man, we sell technology. That is our mission. Is that it, really? Philips Healthcare sells technology, but they are on a mission to make hospital staff more effective. Blackbaud sells software, but they are on a mission to help nonprofits achieve their missions. You get the idea. The question is, what is your compelling mission? Somebody is going to capture more market share in this downturn. Why should it be you? So this next tactic for the tech leader is really focusing on winning capabilities no matter what. From the economic sentiment survey I referenced earlier, 70% of respondents stated that their largest source of revenues over the next four quarters would be from subscriptions and services. TSIA strongly believes the growth levers for all technology providers is changing. In fact, we just published a book titled Digital Hesitation, which outlines how tech companies will cost-effectively grow subscription and service revenues in the future. These are the capabilities that all technology providers should be exploring, regardless of specific markets. So lean into capabilities that accelerate the cost-effective growth of subscription and service revenue streams. To learn more about those capabilities, go read the Stinkit book. Software is eating the world. Here is a clip where Justin Rhodes explains how that reality is impacting John Deere.
I think this is a journey that a lot of companies like ours have to go down, reinventing how they think about this. Even as you mentioned at the outset, we're a 186-year-old company. And, you know, the excellence of John Deere for generations has been on engineering amazing products and manufacturing them, working with our dealers and customers to sort of get them in the field. But we realized about 10 years ago that we actually needed to move away from a very equipment-centric worldview to say, how do I make the best tractor? How do I make my tractor slightly better next year and next year? To a more customer-centric point of view, where we say, you know, a customer doesn't tractor. The customer grows corn. They do jobs with a tractor. And so if we really put the focus on our customers and switched our business structure to actually reflect that now, instead of having a tractor business and a sprayer business and a harvesting business, we have a business that's organized around what we call production systems, which essentially means that in our corn production system, we have true experts that understand the grower's P&L. They understand how technology, data, our equipment can impact that for the better. And that serves as the basis to the product and service roadmap that we actually then decide to fund and ultimately engineer and bring to market. Doing that has been eye-opening for us and given us great insight into the challenges our customers face. And ultimately, we think there's something on the order of $150 billion of value to be unlocked through leveraging the technology that we see as relevant on our machines. That's obviously a wide range of things, including things like we've talked about, saving on fertilizer or herbicide, ultimately driving higher yields on the same amount of land, and then getting the work done faster, like we talked about in the autonomy example.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting as we watch technology companies who historically were focused on making a great product, which is what you described, right? And again, it doesn't matter if you're an enterprise software company or John Deere and you're making a tractor, and now moving to be more focused on the customer outcomes, the customer process. The thing I'll tell you, and this is working in your favor, is companies like John Deere who are vertically oriented by nature, right? You're focused on agriculture. You know, when you lead into this, you get there quicker because it's all you focus on, right? It's not like you're trying to sell a tractor to financial services and manufacturing and a bunch of different vertical industries. And so the ramp is faster, right? Because you're like, hey, this is the industry that we have to know. So I think it's going to be exciting to watch, you know, you go on that journey, because as you do, you're just going to be able to create more and more compelling offers for the customer. But you said it, we have to understand what the customer is doing day in and day out at a level of intimacy that historically we didn't have to worry about. We just had to worry about having a great product. So yeah, it's fascinating to watch.
You know, look, you alluded to it. I honestly think part of being a 186-year-old company is that being driven by a higher purpose and the fact that we're that old and have been successful for that long, I don't think those are coincidental. Mm-hmm. We describe our purpose as we run so life can leap forward. And what that means to us is that we're delivering these intelligent connected machines to revolutionize agriculture and unlock customer value in sustainable ways. Now, there's a lot packed into what I just said, but really, I don't think there's that many companies or executives that can wake up in the morning, look in the mirror and say, I have a business where we can truly help our customers be more successful, help drive sustainable outcomes, and make money ourselves. And pretty much every one of our technologies and products checks all three of those boxes. It's obviously a big job. And I think, you know, to your question, it's been resonating really strongly with talent. It probably takes a little more explaining than, you know, some of the more mainstream technology jobs. But we've started to put together some really interesting campaigns to go and reach out to talent where we say things like, you can choose to scroll your social media feed, or you can code for a company that's helping, you know, build shelter and feed the world. You know, things like that to try and draw the distinction and the real merit in what we're doing. I think we're finding that's a pretty great value proposition for the talent that we're talking to. And it's an opportunity that not a lot of tech companies can offer to have that intersection across all those areas of goodness. And frankly, the people that we're hiring, maybe we're attracting people that are really attracted to that mission, because our employee feedback tells us that the company's reputation, the values of the company are among the top reasons why they're choosing to work for John Deere, that they're inspired by that higher purpose. So once we get a recruit in the door, we also ask them, why did they come and are we meeting their expectations? And again, the good news is 90% are saying that we are and that we're consistent with those values that we're laying out. So I think it's a really, really powerful lens through which to view the world, reason to get out of bed every morning to go to work, and I hope that we can keep delivering that for certainly the rest of my career.
Corporate culture can be a fuzzy concept. In this clip, Jessica Kriegel provides a crystal clear definition of corporate culture.
Looking at broadly many different organizations across industries to see what works to drive results and what doesn't. So most recently, we did some research with 243 organizations. Big ones like McDonald's were in there, Hormel. I mean, some of the organizations we were studying had 350,000 employees and more mid-market organizations. We looked at their strategy, we looked at their purpose, we looked at their culture, and we looked at their revenue over the course of 3 years to see what really drove results, what was significantly correlated with differentiating between their competitors and the other organizations in that group. And what we found, not surprising to me, but maybe surprising to some of the listeners that you have, is that those with strong culture drove the most significant growth. Much more than those with great strategy and much more than those with a clear purpose, culture was the driver of revenue growth over the course of 3 years to the tune of 4x. I mean, companies that had strong culture had 4x more revenue growth than those with weak culture. So culture is the way.
So I really want to understand, when we say the term culture and we say we're, you know, strong culture versus weak culture, what do you start to look at there to test for the culture is actually strong, right? What are attributes the company can zero in on?
Great question. So it's different if we're working with a client and if we're doing research. Those are two different questions. When we're working with a client, culture is measured by their results. If they achieve their results, they've got a strong culture because we've designed their culture around the results that they are hoping to achieve. And if they don't achieve their results, then their culture is not working for them. It's not about whether people are happy. And that's what a lot of engagement surveys identify, and it fails to actually make a difference in the business if people are happy, but they're not executing accordingly. So we measure culture by results with our clients. When we're doing research, however, we're trying to identify what in particular drove those results. So we can't measure culture with results. So we measure it by the way that people think and act. That's the simplest definition of culture that we have, and that resonates with all of the leaders we work with. It's how people think and act to get results. The way people think and act is aligned with strategy and aligned with purpose. You get certain results. And when they're not, you get other results.
So I'm going to throw a question at you, because I can imagine, as you talk to leadership teams and you're starting a conversation about how important culture is to ultimate success, that a starting point often would be, I can just see a CEO or the head of human resources saying, oh, you know, our company, we've got a great culture. That's their starting point, right? We've got a great culture. And so if somebody just throws that on the table in that assertion, what is your typical reaction? Like, how do you move them off of that sort of blanket statement and just that assertion that our culture is great? Who doesn't think they have a great culture?
Well, I'll agree with them. I said, I'm sure you do have a great culture. Your culture is perfectly aligned to the results that you're getting today. That's what your culture is. And we're not the kind of culture consulting firm Culture Partners isn't, where we come in and we figure out, oh, here's all the things that are wrong with your culture that you need to fix. Those are consultants that come in. They're trying to kick up problems in order to upsell more services later. So they'll come in and they'll do a bunch of interviews and say, what makes you unhappy? What isn't working? What needs to be fixed, right? And then they present this list to the executive team of all of the challenges that they've been told and say, this is what you need to fix and here's the cost, right? We don't do that. Yeah. We start by identifying the results that you want to achieve. And those results are how we're going to align your culture. We're not going to spend a bunch of time trying to figure out what you people think are wrong with your culture. And in order to achieve transformative results, next level results, which literally every company is trying to do right now, whether that be in the form of growth, accelerating, scaling, whether it be in the form of adjusting to a massive change in the industry, supply chain issues, AI, working from home, whatever that dynamic may be, if you're trying to get new results in new conditions and adapt accordingly, that's what we're expert in. We come in and say, what are you trying to achieve? We're going to help you create the culture that will align to those results, not the ones you're getting today. Yes, the culture equation is purpose plus strategy powered by culture, meaning it's to the culture power, and that equals results. So your purpose is your why, your strategy is your how, and your culture is the way to get results. What we do when we begin any engagement with a client is we start by identifying their culture equation. We're actually culture agnostic. We don't have a particular culture that we're trying to get everyone to do. We're not trying to get everyone to be innovative or to get everyone to be collaborative. We're not trying to sell an angle because, like I said before, everyone has different preferences. And what we're trying to do is help companies adapt their culture in response to their changing strategy and in alignment with their purpose so that there's one cohesive story about who we are and how we act, the way we think and act to get results. That's ultimately what the culture equation is.
Just to make this real for somebody, can you give a simple illustration of, let me give you an example of a purpose, a strategy that would be aligned with that purpose, and then a culture that would support that? I mean, just a simple version of that, that people could make this tangible.
Yeah. So I'll tell you what I did when I first invented the culture equation. It was my very first. And it was a pro bono engagement I did with a board that I was on. I was on the Sacramento Philharmonic and Opera Board. And they were two organizations that had just merged, two very different cultures, the Philharmonic and the Opera. And they were both struggling financially. This merger was an attempt to save performing arts in Sacramento. And these boards merged, and it was challenging. It was a clash of cultures and a clash of direction, of strategies, of purpose. And so what we had to do is we had to come up with one unified vision. Their purpose statement for the opera was to engage in the historic art of opera by blah, 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 blah. I mean, it was, I can't even remember it. It was like two sentences long. It was very verbose and sounded good, I guess, but then who knows what it was. And I don't think anyone, not even the executive director, could remember it. And the same with the Philharmonic. So the first thing we do is we get very clear on our purpose. And the purpose that we came up with together was, our purpose is to engage the community in music. Period. It felt true for both sides. It was clear. It was a rallying cry. Then we came up with particular strategic anchors. There were some around operational excellence. There were some around attracting a younger audience, because as you can imagine, those audiences were probably older.
Part of the strategy.
And then there were some about the team and merging and engaging the team at a new level so that we could operate not as silos, but as one unified effort. And then we identified metrics, key results is what we call them, to know if we're winning. And those key results need to have three things. They need to be meaningful, they need to be measurable, and they need to be memorable. So they're meaningful to the purpose and the strategy, they're memorable, so everyone knows what they are, and they're measurable, they are a number. Once we identified that strategy, those were all the key components of the strategy, then we identified the cultural beliefs, the way in which people needed to act. These are not values that are timeless and never end. These are particular beliefs we need to hold in order to activate that strategy. Now, we lean on a model called the results pyramid to drive activating culture. And the results pyramid, it has results at the top, appropriately named, right? That is the pinnacle. What we're trying to achieve is those results. What drives results is people's actions, right? It's the way that people act. It's what they do every day. That's what's going to either get you your results or not. Well, that's where most leaders stop, and where a lot of culture efforts fail is that we think about what we need people to do and what we want to achieve, and we just go back and forth between those two things, thinking about actions like a new technology or a new payroll system or a new training program, or we're going to reorganize the team. And all of those are action focused that maybe help in getting a result. But ultimately, what we're trying to do is change the way people think and act to get results. Mm-hmm. That's the action trap, right? We need to go beneath the action trap to the thing that drives actions. So do you have a guess for the thing that drives your actions, like what drives what you do every day?
So I would say I'm thinking for myself, but I also bring back the lens. If I think about employees in a company, I would say how they're rewarded, compensation's got to be part of that, and what the company celebrates maybe as well in terms of what they're going to get recognized for just outside of compensation. So I would put, I'm guessing those are two things that are probably going to motivate me when I come in.
Exactly. All of those things are signals for what is valued, right?
Right.
What cultural beliefs do we recognize? You know, what behavior do we recognize? And when am I compensated? It's the beliefs, ultimately, that we're trying to foster. If I see you being transparent and transparency is value, and then I reward you for that transparency, you're now going to believe that transparency helps you get ahead, and you're going to be transparent in your actions, right?
Yep.
So the actions we take are driven by our mindsets, the way we think, the beliefs that we have, which are all informed by exactly what you said, experiences. Leaders create experiences in the rewards that they give. They create experiences in the feedback that they give. They create experiences in the stories that they tell. And so those experiences drive the right beliefs. And when you get that right, you start to create sustained behavioral change. You start to get people to take action proactively rather than having to micromanage them because you're constantly focused on actions as a leader. And that is really the model that we work through with our teams to understand intentionally what beliefs need to be crafted and how to create experiences that will get you those beliefs in the hearts and minds of your employees through tools such as recognition, storytelling, feedback, and many, many more. So we give them these culture management tools that then they implement, and that's how you actually operationalize behavior change.
In this clip, David Judge from Microsoft explains how they are driving the adoption of AI capabilities by Microsoft employees.
So I agree with you that we're heading in that direction. What we're finding in practice is that the nudge is very effective and sort of the next best action recommendation is very effective. It is most effective when we give them some understanding and some argumentation about why.
Interesting. Okay, yeah. Context.
Like people need to understand. Like, so just say, hey, go do this. They're like, nah, I don't know if this matches up with my understanding of
yeah. that.
So we need to give them the argumentation around, hey, well, we're seeing this, we're seeing that. We think that this is probably the next best action for you.
Yeah.
And by the way, help us understand if this is true or not so that we can actually help the models get a little bit better
yeah.
the next time we make a recommendation. So, you know, if you extrapolate this out over a sufficient time scale, I think we're heading much more in that direction. But, you know, we're working with people and people are working with people on the customer side. So they need to have the help and the confidence that that's correct and can help have those conversations.
Yeah, that makes really good sense. And so that kind of leads to this question I have around just adoption, employee adoption. So obviously, you know, you're sitting here at Microsoft, you're making the technology, you say, hey, our employees are going to be super jazzed about it. So yes, they're going to adopt it. But I would bet a dollar that even within Microsoft, you still have to navigate this fact that just because the technology is there, doesn't mean, like you just said, you might have a wicked smart CSM or support engineer who says, you know, I've been doing this a long time. I don't need the best action from this piece of software, right? So tell me a little bit about how you drive successful adoption of the tools.
If we think about sort of the insights aspect of this, it's important because the better insights get better adoption.
Yeah.
Like if you did best actions that match up with their realities get better yeah. adoption. And then start to trust a little bit more. So we like to think about the what, like sort of the map of the territory. Like we've got to have a consensus reality around what the data is yep. telling us. There needs to be like a so what after that. Like, what do we do now? Like it matters. And then the now what is ultimately where we want those folks to live, which is taking action on what those what and so whats are telling them probably is the case that needs to happen. So listen, it's a trust building exercise. It's also making sure that we're creating a continuous learning organization. You would have seen this in a lot of what we talk about publicly, that we have a learn-it-all culture, not a know-it-all culture. So we work with people to make sure that they're thinking in a very progressive way, how they're going to start to adopt new technologies continuously. And think about it. Think like, what's the art of the possible around this? With that breeds, you know, enthusiasm. It provides energy for the field. It also provides energy for our customers because we're, you know, we're consuming some of the great things that we're asking them to go consume as well. So I think it's a little bit of both. It's being rigorous around how the data turns into action and how we use that technology, but then making sure we've got a field and an organization that's continuously learning about how to do it.
In this clip, we hear from Jim Roth, the president of customer success at Salesforce, as he describes how Salesforce has structured their massive service organization and how they approach assessing customer health.
Yeah, we've combined those two and customer training. So the mm-hmm. way we think about it is we think about what are all the services our customers need throughout the full life cycle? And we contrast those with the services customers need from time to time. And so you get this kind of bimodal split. The services customers need from time to time are project-based services with a start and an end date. That could be for an implementation. It could be because yep. you acquired a company, you're divesting of something, you're buying a net new product, any of those types of things. And those are what we think of as professional services, start yep. and end date, project-based. And then everything else, we believe, are customer success services. That's what we call it. That's the umbrella we put over it. And if we were a company that had a physical product, we would, you know, include things like field service mm-hmm. in there as well. And so when we think about those capabilities, our goal is to integrate them into one experience. We talk all the time ourselves about how we never want our customers to feel our org chart. That's yep. a really key point. You never want your customers to feel your org chart. And I would say that any company on this planet of any size that is delivering service has this problem. It's very hard to not have this problem in some shape or form, but that is our aspiration to kind of break that down. So when you talk about combining these things, we still have people that their full-time job is technical support engineer. And we mm-hmm. still have people who their job is a customer success manager. And we still have people whose job is to deliver customer training. So we have those roles, but we have integrated them in one experience. And the couple of things we've done, I'd say, that are interesting are when we started this journey, customer success and customer support each had their own portal, all mm-hmm. with good intention.
Yeah,
they
yeah.
had And so then you get to customers and you're saying, well, which portal do I go to? And even Google is confused when you have multiple portals, doesn't know where to send you. So we said, okay,
one
of the first things we do is let's go get to one website. That makes more sense, right? They had a lot of similarities, but let's bring them together. We also had two roles that were customer facing and were kind of, I'm your single point of contact. In customer support, it was called a TAM, a technical account manager.
Mm-hmm.
And in customer success, it was called a success manager.
Yeah.
And so one of the things we've done over the last year is we've kind of brought those roles together into one role that we call customer success manager. So we're really integrating the experience, trying to have a veneer for the customer that says, hey, we have one experience. You have bought one service. We think about it as a super service, support, success, and training together. One experience. Now, behind the scenes, we certainly have specialization. We have support engineers that specialize in products. We have architects that specialize in products. But we have one orchestrated experience, one veneer, so customers don't feel our org chart. Yeah. I mean, we think about customer health and we define it as to be healthy, you have to have a strong implementation, right? So it's up and running and very stable and high performing. And you have to be adopting both the licenses you purchase, the features of those products, and any of the consumption units that are in those products. We want that. The great thing about education and training customers more on your products, it actually helps both of those. We see that when customers are more trained, they have healthier implementations and better adoption. So it's kind of this force multiplier to drive customer health. And so you're right. It's been on the side. It hasn't been pulled through. We think it's a big unlock by really putting it front and center in the experience. One other thing I've learned through this too, because customers, when I share this with them, we sometimes have a conversation around, hey, how would I think about having a customer success score? And you're right, in companies with CS, a lot of companies have it. But if you don't have CS, if you're just a traditional product company, this is kind of still a new concept and they don't really have these things. So one of the things I've learned that's important for the listeners is when you have this conversation around customer success or customer health, everybody kind of measures it. They might use different words. But you really have to be critical with what you're using and what you're measuring. Oftentimes, when I ask customers, well, how do you measure customer success? I'll hear things like a revenue metric, a churn metric, some sort of, you know, bookings measure or whatever. And you have to be really careful because those are, in fact, measures of your own success, not your customer success. So one of the heuristics that we use internally is we say this, if we're considering a new signal in these scores, here's the divide we look at, which is, if we would actually sit down and talk with a customer about it, then it's a candidate to be in the customer success score. However, if it's only a signal that we would talk with our CFO about, then it's probably a measure of Salesforce success. And so we only put things in the health score that we would actually sit down and talk to a customer about, because those, in fact, would be customer success measures, not our own success. Now, our own success is still important, but we believe if we drive customer health, that leads to our own success, and you can't kind of conflate the two.
In this clip, we hear from the CEO of Reef AI, Brent Grimes, as he describes practical approaches to leverage AI to unlock revenue growth.
Sure. And when you talk about AI, there's definitely different categories of AI. And there's been a lot of frenzy around generative AI. And most of the use cases to date around generative AI have been really productivity focused and less directly and squarely focused on revenue. And so what we found is that the best opportunity in the short term for revenue gain is the tried and true area of AI, which is machine learning. And so the ability to take advantage of a lot of customer data that most organizations have, apply machine learning in a way that you can get good at predicting churn risk, get good at predicting downgrade risk, using proven machine learning and data science approaches to do better selective investment in customers well in advance of that renewal cycle, engage them while there's time to still mitigate risk, and give the people involved some idea of the best actions they can take to mitigate that risk, can have a really profound impact on renewal performance. And I think that there's a lot of companies that struggle either because they're trying to still use a generalized health score to do risk mitigation, or maybe they do have data science teams, but those data science teams don't really understand the mechanics of go-to-market or really understand the problem space, or they can build a model, but it's very difficult to take a model and then go operationalize it, right? So we found by helping organizations close the gap between data science and go-to-market and really plug their data into Reef, get good, effective churn prediction scoring models, downgrade prediction scoring models, notify their team with recommendations and track the effectiveness and the ROI on those recommendations, that we have the ability within 2 to 3 quarters deliver substantial ROI on churn prevention, risk mitigation around renewals in a way that has been very repeatable across different customers.
Now, I have to ask a follow-up question here in terms of, you have a machine learning model. It is helping you understand, oh, these are the risk factors, and let's, you know, start creating some, you know, let's flag them. Let's start doing some mitigation. I'm curious, in your experience, as you've been deploying this now, right, directly, you know, the first time you ever did this, and plus, you know, other customers, I'm going to put a dollar on the table and a guess. I will guess that by using the machine learning model, often a customer will learn that there are variables impacting renewal that they did not realize, that basically the model's coming back and saying, well, you know, this is a problem. And they look at it and go, well, that was never on our health score. Really? And I'm curious, is that something that plays out?
Yeah, 100%. So there's always a few things that are instinctual that they want to test and get validation on. But in every case, there are surprises or things that weren't as obvious that emerge as part of that process. I mean, even when we did this at MuleSoft, a great example of this is, and this is more of an expansion or upsell case, but the premise still applies, is one of the things that we learned in our analysis that we were completely blind to was that prior to an expansion, there was an upswell in kind of marketing engagement activity, right? So more people coming to events, more people coming to the website. And like, if you reverse engineer it, it makes perfect sense, right? If they're talking about expansion internally, there's probably more people getting involved that are coming and checking out who you are and what you're all about. And so it makes sense, but we were completely blind to this signal because it wasn't something that was connected to our kind of sales tech stack, right? It lived separately within marketing. By pulling this in, it allowed us to design a play to say, look, when we see this signal, we don't want that customer making the decision on their own without our input. We want to be part of that conversation because we can help, one, make sure that it actually materializes into expansion. And two, we could probably help increase the size of the deal, scope of what they're doing, and shape it into something larger than it would be if we just let them run with it organically. So these are the kind of insights that typically come out in these analyses that bring new tools to bear that allow you to really get much more surgical in the way that you go after these opportunities or these risks in a way that can really change revenue outcomes.
Data that requires people to enter and upkeep that information, right? I think that's where a lot of companies, you know, try to drive improvement by saying, hey, we're going to capture a lot of information about our customers and our, you know, our AEs or our CSMs are going to keep that information up to date. And that's going to be a reliable source of influence for us. And what we found is that, like, when it comes to building these models and what actually correlates to churn or growth, it doesn't ever have a very significant impact, right? And you can get enough. I think I have a point of view that it's a waste of capacity to have people enter and upkeep a lot of information manually. I think that there's enough signal in the data that you're capturing already to help you prioritize in a really effective way. And you can take the cycles that people are spending on data entry and put those actually into customer engagement and things that are going to move the needle.
And that's a wrap on our 100th episode. Thank you so much for listening and for being a part of TSIA's Tectonic community. We're incredibly grateful to have you. But we're just getting started. There's so much more to examine and more conversations that matter to be had. So stick with us, subscribe, share, and keep tuning in. Here's to the next 100.